This is a CBC podcast.
Hey, this is the Q interview from CBC Podcasts and from Q on CBC Radio 1. I'm Caitlin Swan, the producer of this thing, and Tom Power, your usual host, is busy watching the movie Gremlins on loop. So, while Tom's away, I'm bringing you this fantastic conversation with today's guest, Wynn Butler. Wynn co-founded Arcade Fire, a band that's defined like a whole generation of indie rock. He caught up with Tom Power just as their latest record, We, came out. Arcade Fire is also headlining the music festival Oceaga in Montreal this Friday. Here's Tom's conversation with Arcade Fire member Wynn Butler.
How are you?
I'm great.
I'm glad to hear it. It's been busy for you. I see you've been doing a lot of chatting about the record.
Man, it's been a long time since we did the whole releasing an album thing. You forget.
How you find it?
Man, like jet lag is a thing.
Yeah.
Sleeping in a hotel. Like, oh, right.
It's an interesting thing to do, right? Because coming out of the pandemic, I think there was like, when I was doing research for this interview, I think there would be artists who experienced the pandemic and sort of gave themselves a bit of a break to stop making anything, you know? I know folks who got into gardening and never wrote a song once, but I was interested that you and Regine never really stopped making music. Can you talk a little bit about what that time was like for you?
We were just getting started. We were in a studio in New Orleans, and we actually just cut the first version of End of the Empire. I think we had Age of Anxiety at that point. We were working on a couple songs and checked my phone, and I was like, oh, the borders to Canada are closing. Like, it's go time. Like, I feel like I've been preparing for my whole life for the end of the world to finally be happy. It's like, it's happening.
Were you a bit of a prepper? Like, were you hoarding Sprite down in gas containers in your basement or anything?
No, unfortunately. No.
All right, right.
I had no toilet paper, just like all the rest of us. But, you know, it's like you spend your whole life, you know, watching science fiction and reading science fiction. You're like, oh, wow, this is eerily familiar. And then I was actually calculating, that would have been in, February?
Yeah, late February 2020, yeah.
Late Feb, and then by the time I was able to get the band together, it was late October. So March, April, May, June, July, August, September. So 7-8 months of like unplanned writing time. And the whole time just trying to logistically jump through hoops and figure out how to get everyone together. It was definitely an intense, and we were already in this full-on writing mode, so it was like once that ship has sailed, unfortunately, you don't get to, you kind of have to listen when you're inspired.
But that's sort of what I'm curious about. Like, unplanned time off is unplanned writing mode. You wanted to keep writing, you wanted to still keep going, even if it was just you and herself at the piano.
I mean, it was sort of survival, to be honest. It was such a bizarre time, and you know, I'm someone who I really started writing music when I was 15. I went away to boarding school, and I was, you know, my family was in Texas and I was in New Hampshire, and it was like winter time, and I was so depressed, you know, just like so just profoundly homesick and depressed. But I mean, it was exciting because I was, you know, meeting all these really interesting kids who were really smart, and you know, I had an amazing English teacher, and I was like really like on a certain level it was really exciting, but then I was like barely surviving. And for me, music was like always my just my lifeline, you know. And so it didn't really start as like a pastime or anything for me. It almost started more like medicine. And so then I think when this all went down, it felt very familiar. It almost felt like a flashback to that time where it's like that's your lifeboat. You just hold on to dear life.
I have a couple questions on that. One, what were the songs you were writing at boarding school like?
I had a roommate. I had a four track, cassette four track, and a lot of it was sort of jokey. Like, you know, it's like we were like, oh, we're not making songs. Like we were, it was like a lot of it was couched in this sort of like pretending to be jokey sort of thing.
Like ironic, funny songs, or were they like
not like Weird Al?
you weren't writing parody songs of, yeah, I understand.
Oh, I'm trying to think of an example.
Like the Mountain Goats or something like that. Like it's kind of funny and acerbic and, you know, I don't know.
Maybe it was more like we were too self-conscious to like admit that we cared sort of. And we were just, it was just like these little dumb little things, you know, we would record on the four track and then, but you know, just like dozens of them, and then, you know, and then at a certain point, I was like, I think that I really care about this, and I'm just pretending not to care about it because I think it'll make me seem less lame or something like that.
Yeah, there's a great irony there that, you know, when you say something like, you know, we were trying to couch the fact that we did care because we thought it was very uncool to care. Like, I feel like your band, in some ways, unlocked for a lot of us, like, the coolness of caring.
I got over the not caring thing pretty quick. Yeah. I was like, well, this is not me really. And then, you know, like a lot of people, it was like more of a cover band. I think the first time we did a cover of, Just Like Heaven by The Cure. That was like my first time playing in front of people.
Yeah.
And I had to sit down because I couldn't stand up and play guitar at the same time. You know, it's just like just a lousy high school guitar player. Yeah, I mean, I think just because my family is so musical, like my grandfather played in big bands and my mother's an incredible musician. And it was always – they never really presented it to me that music was something that like an occupation that was just sort of something that you did every day. So – I never had any existential doubts of like, oh, could I be a musician when I grew up? You know, it's like it seemed like that was the most normal thing I could do in a lot of ways.
I want to talk about your grandfather a little bit later, but I want to go back to the idea that you were writing as a lifeline through this pandemic. And it reminded you of those early days in New Hampshire when you were writing as a lifeline, when you were at boarding school away from the family. When you're writing these songs at home during the pandemic, are they in any way different because there's not the immediacy of like, oh, in a couple of days I might be able to show this to the band, or in a couple of months I might be able to play these on stage with the band?
Well, I mean, to be honest, the process for writing a record is very long. So, I mean, it's not that uncommon for me to spend a year writing without anyone in the band hearing anything. It's like Regine and I are always just sort of writing, you know, it's just sort of like when the spirit comes, you know what I mean? It's like, I remember reading something with Neil Young where he like his family had an understanding. It's like at any point, if he like gave the sign, then he had a pass just to disappear immediately and, you know, go get the song down. So I think it's the same thing. It's like my son knows, he's like, if he's asked me the same question like 9 times in a row and I haven't responded, the dad is probably, you know, thinking about a melody or thinking about like a turn of phrase or something like that.
I have a couple of friends who are songwriters and they'll often say to me, like, sorry, I didn't text back. I had to write a song. And I have to be understanding of that. You're right.
Yeah, you have to. I mean, I've done it enough times where you don't listen and then it's gone forever. And you're like, well, that's gone forever.
when you announced the new record, you also put out a letter talking about a book from your childhood that had the word "we" stamped on the cover. And this was a book that I only knew in reference to other books. I wonder if you could tell people who aren't familiar with it, tell me a little bit about the book and maybe how it was influencing you.
Well, I mean, it's funny because the original book, when I was a very little kid, my grandmother was, this is my family in Maine, my kind of New England family, actually, who have roots in Canada. I definitely have some ancestors that come from your part of the world, from St. John's and New Brunswick. And
lots of butlers around my way too, right?
Yeah, I don't know. It's a little hazy back there, but there's definitely some because, you know, where my parents live is called Acadia. And it was like, you know, the French pass through there as well. And it was like a lot of it's very French Canadian. My grandfather was obsessed with like Kipling. They would read me a lot of that sort of stuff, which really I trace a lot of my love of language back to that, just like hearing Kipling stories. But she read me, I believe it was like a biography of the first flight across
Lindbergh.
Because that generation, like the Lindbergh flight was like as big as the space like mission to the moon. It was like he was like the most famous person.
Yeah, the Lindbergh baby kidnapping was like the biggest thing that had ever happened in history at that point.
But I don't even remember the book. I remember being really confused as to why it was called We as well. I was like, what does this mean? And then when I moved to Montreal, I was minoring in Russian literature. I took a class on the 20s, like the right around the Russian Revolution. And there's a book by Zamyatin that's called We that 1984 is based on, and Brave New World, but 1984 directly. And Orwell was always one of my favorite, I mean, maybe the most influential writer on me. And I was like, wait, he got the entire story from this Russian story. And then there was just something, the name resonated with me from when I was a kid. And it was like just this word, you know, like this very simple word. But it had this sort of depth of meaning to me personally.
Was it influencing the songs on the record?
It was more like I realized that that's what the songs were. You know, it's like every album we've ever done, I've had some seed of what it is. Like way back, and you're just sort of remembering what it is as you go along. You know, it's like Suburbs was an idea for like a science fiction film that I had when I was 17. And, you know, there's always like something that's already in there that you're trying to kind of uncover the layers of. And with We, I always knew I would do something called We. I just didn't know it was this record until the record was almost written. I was like, oh, that's what this is. This record is We.
I want to listen to one of the tracks off the record. I want to listen to a couple of tracks off the record today. So I want to start with this one.
Rabbit hole. Yeah. Plastic soul.
Yeah.
So real rabbit hole. Yeah, rabbit hole. Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Talk to me a little bit about Age of Anxiety.
Regine was playing this little, we were working on a different song, I can't remember, and she was playing the chords, and we just sort of like stop everything that, and I programmed this quick little drum machine thing, and it was just like one of those instinctive things where you're working on something totally different. And like when you say rabbit hole, it's like everyone knows what you're talking about. It's like such a modern, like everyone's been in the rabbit hole where it's like you think you're looking for something and you end up finding something totally different.
You're on Wikipedia reading one article and you end up 3 hours later reading about the history of baseball socks.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. You follow this weird chain and you end up somewhere totally different. And yeah. It's interesting, like there's sort of a Bowie reference in it. The second line is like plastic soul. Called like kind of fame, he called Plastic Soul. It was like a genre. And I had a portrait of him in the studio. And the first vocal take that's actually the song, I was singing it and my engineer and I finishing the take and we heard this sound. We were like, what is that sound? I took off my headphones and my phone, which is on the other side of the studio, started playing a song from Low, like just of its own accord. It like wasn't on a playlist or anything like that. And it was in the same key. And it was just like, I have a video of it somewhere. I'm going to have to dig it out. And it was just so, I was like, I really don't even believe in that sort of stuff. But it was like, it is what it is. like, hi, David, how's it going? So I don't know. I mean, until the world is made whole, one body, one soul. I think that's my favorite lyric in it.
Why?
Because that's what I'm waiting for, you know, just waiting for some sort of like healing and some sort of coming together and kind of hope, some sort of hope through the blackness.
That's something I wanted to ask you about. You know, when I listen to, so I'll say a couple of things here. One is that you can listen to an Arcade Fire song and have a great personal relationship with it. And then you can read a review of an Arcade Fire song and realize you have no idea what, it turns out you were wrong all along. And what you thought the song was about when you heard it, it turns out, according to this person, it's 100% not what it's about. But I'll talk about this. I'll talk about what the song made me think of, and I don't think it's that far off, you know. Listening to Age of Anxiety made me think about a lot of things that a lot of us were dealing with through the pandemic. The idea of being separated from one another physically, the artifice of seeming like we were connected to one another through social media, which are, of course, these billion-dollar corporations. And how ultimately we live in a time when there's higher instances of anxiety and higher instances of depression, and we can attribute some of that stuff directly to. I mean, there's studies that exist that we can attribute that to, you know, increased use of social media, lack of community, lack of being close to one another. I wanted to know if you are immune from that, the anxiety of our age.
No, not at all, because it's completely contagious, you know? So it's like, I think that we always project whatever we're going through onto everyone else. And it's like, it's sort of this weird feedback loop. It's almost like weather systems, you know what I mean? It's like, particularly over the last couple of years, as we've been home, you can just see these big kind of weather systems of anxiety blowing through. And, you know, I just think it's an aspect of just like having way too much information and not enough connection just to like the here and now of kind of our day-to-day lives. It's like we're constantly being pulled out of the moment. And so it's like, I don't know. I mean, I think every generation has sort of struggled with this, and it's, you know, it's not like technology is bad, and you know it's nothing like that, but it's more just like trying to understand these like big weather systems that are affecting all of us.
How does it affect you personally?
Well, I don't know. I mean, like all music, you know, since we started as a band, you know, when we started, the dream was to sell 10,000 records and quit our day job and make a second record. And streaming has completely changed. Basically has annihilated the record and made it so that the record is not – I don't mean the physical record. I mean like the album is like
– The idea of a sequence of songs that one would listen to from beginning to end.
Yeah. That's not in the protocol of how these things are set up. So it's like I grew up listening to Beatles records and Bowie records and Clash records and Radiohead records and Bjork records. It wasn't like – a random jogging playlist of like, here's 9 random Bjork songs with like a lot of other random, you know,
with a PJ Harvey song in there or yeah, that kind of thing.
We would make, you know, obviously like cassette, you know, playlists and that sort of thing. But I don't know, is there a playlist that's better than like the White Album? I don't know. It's like, I actually read an article the other day where someone was like, I fixed the White Album. Like I removed all the boring songs and like here's the 10 songs that if they had done it, it would have been great. I'm like, who are you again? Like, and if, why do you think that you can improve the freaking White Album? Like
I like the idea of McCartney listening to that and going, nah, they're right. Yeah, you know what?
Why weren't they there when we were doing it? Like, like Bungalow Bill is a real stinker, you know? It's so absurd. It's like, oh man, if only they could have come in a time machine and helped us make our album, like, you know.
The back half of the album, if you don't mind me saying so, is a very hopeful record in a time when it's not easy to be hopeful. Is it important to you to sing about hope on your records?
I think it can be anything. I mean, like, I think that there's hope in just sort of in pain as well. I don't think they're so different from each other. I think that, you know, I've been very uplifted by Billie Holiday and Nina Simone, and I've been very uplifted by music that was made by people who are in a tremendous amount of pain and just trying to come to terms with that. I think it's all around us. It's very easy to get beat down. I mean, I'll go for months and months where I'm just like, oh man, what is the point of all this?
Yeah.
It's like, you know, just like you just feel like you're hitting your head against a wall. But there's always, I mean, particularly, you know, with my son, it's like you just see, you know, so much potential and so much like such a beautiful posture towards the world. And, you know, for me, it just gives me a lot of hope.
More from Tom Power and Arcade Fire's Win Butler coming up in just a second. Back to Tom's conversation with Arcade Fire's co-founder, Win Butler. But first, just a little bit of Arcade Fire's new song, Unconditional Lookout Kid.
Lookout Kid, trust your mind, but you can't trust it every time. You know it plays tricks on you, and it don't give a damn if you're happy or you're sad. But if you've lost it, don't feel bad, because it's all right to be sad.
I love this song. I'll just ask broadly, what can you tell me about writing it?
It's sort of like a Soweto sort of vibe in the rhythm. I was sort of thinking about, you know, my son. I was thinking about my own experience in junior high and high school and just like how difficult it was, and trying to imagine myself now trying to go through what I went through then. And like, I just genuinely don't know if I would have survived, like, you know what I mean? Like, within this kind of new era, like, there's so much, it's so easy to tear other people down, and to, like, there's so many new ways to kind of hurt each other, you know?
Yeah.
And it's very harrowing, you know? And just thinking about, like, my son that I just love, you know, to the ends of the earth, and you're just like, you're just gonna really need to be able to take a punch and keep going, and really just, like, you're just going to have a thick skin, and really that was sort of the root of it, I guess.
Have you played it for him?
Yeah, of course. I mean, he's always in there.
I mean, does he like it?
I don't know. He does now. I'd ask him, like, you know, probably like.
I know. I was thinking the difference. I understand it. You had a hard time in junior high and high school?
Yeah, of course. Who didn't?
Some people didn't. I don't know. But I think they're having a hard time now.
Yeah, no one that I hang out with had a great junior high, but I mean.
Oh, I think it's the death years. I think it's the most deathly of the years in junior high.
Oh, brutal.
Yeah, really, really rough. Okay, I promised I was going to talk to you about this. I want to talk to you about it. Just take a listen to this. You know, do you recognize that?
Yeah, it makes me cry. I miss him a lot. Yeah.
That's your grandfather.
Yeah.
What was his name?
Alvino.
Do you want to take a second? We totally can.
No, it's cool. No, he's he was a very special dude.
Great musician.
Yeah, amazing. The best. He was the second jazz guitar player in New York City. You know, he was
really?
Basically, yeah.
Really?
Yeah. I have his guitar that he got from Eddie Lang, who was the first jazz guitar player in New York City. It's like an old Gibson. His photos are all over my house. Like, you know, he was, you know, in a lot of ways, definitely what I'm doing now was from his influence, not even anything he said, just, you know, how he was. I know he definitely went through some shit in his life. You know, he was like in World War II, and he was living in New York when the stock market crash happened. But, you know, he's someone whose memory we definitely keep alive.
When do you remember? This is so cool. Like, when do you remember knowing that, hey, my grandfather is one of the cooler musicians?
I mean, we would visit him. He always had a studio. He was like a very tech, you know, talk about someone having like a positive attitude towards technology. Because he was a kid, he would build radios, like when he was a little kid, like physically build the electronics. And he told me about like cutting down a tree with his dad and making his own radio tower. And he was obsessed with radio. And he had his ham radio license, you know, since 1920 or something like that. He was obsessed with all that stuff. And so I remember visiting him, and every day he'd go down in the basement and you hear him like soloing, like kind of Django Reinhardt, like for an hour. And then you hear like, 9:44 is over, like, and then he'd come up and eat lunch, and then he'd go downstairs, and you're like, like, that was his whole life, basically. It was just like the radio. And but yeah, when he passed, he died right around funeral. We'd named sort of funeral for him, and Regine and I were visiting his basement studio, and he had Pro Tools open and was, you know, had an octave pedal on a guitar and recording bass, like using it to do bass sounds for a thing he was working on. And, you know, he was just like to the very end, like very interested and kind of wanting to see what happens next. So
he must have been some proud of you.
I don't know if he could have related to the music. He was, because he was involved in the first prototype of the Electric, and I think he always regretted it a little bit, you know.
What have I done?
Like, oh, no. Like, it's cool. He's like, rock and roll is cool. Like, the energy is great, but you really should have heard Duke Ellington with, like, a, you know, 60-person orchestra. He's like, you have no idea what you're missing. Like, it was so good.
You said to me when I first played it for you, you said, I think the way he was influenced me.
Yeah.
What do you mean?
Like, I felt like I was talking to a 20-year-old. It was like he was really interested and really like alive in the eyes and really like not like, I don't know, not like blustery and like you got to do it like this or whatever. He just was really in his own, just like very, I don't know, just a really, really beautiful guy.
You said to me earlier that when you were in, because you came, your mom's a musician, because your grandfather's a musician, you kind of grew up with a lot of music in the house. It wasn't something that people did. It was just sort of surrounding you at all times. Was there a moment where you were like, I want to dedicate my life to this?
Well, I sort of realized my mom's a harpist. And when I was a kid, she would always, you know, I'd come home from school and she'd be playing Debussy or, you know, she was like, play a lot of jazz stuff. And I would, when I was like, this is like maybe when I was, when we still lived in California, so I would have been like 2-3 years old, I would like put my head on the soundboard of the harp like this and she would play. So it's like you would get the vibration of the instrument like on your head and it felt really cool. And I was visiting them this summer and I put my head on her harp and plucked a string and I just, it was this out-of-body experience. It's like, you know, when you smell something from your childhood or whatever, it was like that, but on acid. It was like it brought me back immediately to being a kid. And it was like, I sort of had this realization that it's like, that music is really, it's a spirit. You know what I mean? It's like, it's not like a practice. It's like, there's a spiritual dimension to it. It's like this, my head, my ear on the soundboard, like that's, it got into me. It was just like the vibration of that thing hit my brain and my brain was like wired differently from then on. It was like, okay, my brain now, it did something. I don't know how to explain it, but it was like, it was really, really, otherworldly. I was like, oh man, that's where it came from.
Those moments, hey, like those one little tiny moments. There's no way you could have predicted that when you put your head on that harp that was what would have happened, you know?
It reminded me, I was watching a documentary on Vonnegut, and he...
I watched that documentary, the one made by his Robert B. Whitey, the one made about like trying to make a documentary about Vonnegut.
Exactly, yeah. But he had the story of like being in the war and he put his head against a tree and saw everything that was about to happen. It's like the tree, it's like this like weird mystical thing. It was like literally just like he did this and it was like he saw the whole war. And then I think he spent the rest of his life just trying to make sense of it. He's like, am I a crazy person or, you know, like, but I don't know. It was that sort of feeling actually.
When you saw that, you went, I know what that can be.
Man, like I try to not be mystical and spiritual because, you know, my dad's a scientist and you know, I do my best. I'm like the most skeptical person, but every once in a while it's like David Bowie comes in your studio and says what's up and you're like, oh man, there's a lot about this, about all of this that we don't understand.
Yeah, so you end up pursuing music. It sort of takes over, you know. Famously, you're in Montreal, Arcade Fire starts, becomes really, really big. And you mentioned Funeral earlier. I want to play just a little bit of Funeral. I just want to just take a listen to this.
If the children is Wake Up from Funeral, Arcade Fire's 2004 debut.
Wayne, I couldn't have been, I've been holding on this one, like, I could not have been in a better place for this record to have hit me. I was born in 87, so I was in, like, late high school when I heard this record, and it was, I mean, everyone, it didn't matter what else you were into, loved this record. Like, I loved bluegrass and Irish music and Funeral. My friends loved The Smiths and Joy Division and Funeral. My friends loved hip hop, country music, and Funeral. And I've been thinking a lot about it, you know. Well, first off, I shouldn't cut you off, you know. Like, it was a pretty profound record for a lot of people.
Shout out Arlen Thompson on the drums on that from Wolf Parade. That was that when we were before we had a drummer. Yeah, I mean, I remember playing that song for five people. I remember we played that song many times when there were more people in the band than people in the audience, and we would still sing it like that, just so over the top, like we were going to war every single show. And I think we've tried to hold on to that mentality since then.
That's what I'm curious about. Like, I think a lot of the songs were so meaningful to a lot of people who love that record because it was about this sort of transitional time in our lives. And the songs were about, we're talking about death and talking about our parents and talking about growing older. And I was only getting ready for this interview in that I sort of realized, like, he was just in his 20s too. So being now maybe a little bit older, a few decades removed from that, how do you look back on the perspective of the person who wrote those songs?
I mean, we're constantly changing, and, you know, it's like when I met Regine, our influences were so, you know, we had certain things that we came together on, but we had a very broad set of influences. And I think that when we put out Funeral, to my ears, the difference between Seven Kettles and Power Out and Haiti and Rebellion, it's like there's a breadth of kind of some of the underpinning. I think we pulled off a pretty big magic trick insisting that it all makes sense together. But I feel like we're still trying to explore the outer reaches of all that stuff that made us want to do it in the first place. And being on the inside, it doesn't feel any different to us. You know what I mean? It's like, it's still like each new song is kind of new to us, and we're still trying to explore something that we haven't said before.
Yeah, I remember when you guys won the Grammy, there were, like, in Canada, all these messages started going up. Like, everyone happened to have a video of you guys at the Rivoli, or happened to have a video of you guys playing, you know, in front of like eight people, and was sort of sending it back and forth to one another. It blew up so quickly.
I mean, it wasn't that quick. I mean, the record didn't come out for 6 months in the UK. You know, it came out in US and Canada. So, like, it might have felt quick to you guys, but to us, it's like we had been toiling for years and years, you know? It's like, I mean, I'm very grateful that we weren't 18, that, you know, I was 22, 23, and sort of had a little bit more of a head on our shoulders. Because, I've seen a lot of bands that just get a lot of smoke blown at them, and they can't, you know, kind of, that's the death nail. It's like you can never recapture the magic of the thing that you did when you weren't thinking about it or whatever. And for us, I was like, had the instinct just to run away and just keep doing it and not let that stuff affect us too much. But I mean, of course it does, because it's like, you know, you're still in the world and you're still a human, but we're still quite young by country music standards.
I want to get a shirt that says I'm still young by country music standards.
All the blues guys are, you know.
Yeah, I know.
You don't really get good until you're 70.
Lovely to meet you. Thanks for the time.
Thank you.
That's Tom Power's conversation with Wynn Butler of Arcade Fire. Their newest album, We, is out now. And speaking of Arcade Fire, if you're in or around Montreal this week, you can catch them headlining at Oceaga on Friday. I'm Caitlin Swan, the producer of The Pod. Thanks so much for listening. And if you can, please rate, review, subscribe to the podcast. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week, later on.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.